Policing works. Prison doesn't. If we want to cut crime, we can do it by having more policing and fewer people in prison. That may sound a bit implausible, but it's a growing consensus among criminologists. For example, in the February 2011 volume of Criminology and Public Policy, the entire issue is devoted to a paper by Stephen Dirloff and Daniel Nagin in which they echo the U.S. National Academy of Sciences in saying that there's substantial evidence that focused policing, used in the right way, can reduce crime and reduce it cost-effectively, whereas the research on prisons that they have been summarizing is increasingly indicating that for the people who are put in prison, it does not prevent crime, but it actually causes crime. And the benefit of putting them behind bars or incapacitating them is quickly dissipated by the higher frequency with which they commit crime when they get out of prison, at least in the first time that they go to prison, in the strongest study we have, which is one not from the United States or Britain, but it is with a very diverse urban population in Holland, and which is mostly about short sentences, which comprise, of course, a very high proportion of the prison sentences all over the world. And in their review in Criminology and Public Policy, they present the same argument that I have been making for some time about the advisability of cutting the spending on prisons substantially, increasing the spending on policing, or at least not reducing that when you have to reduce, as Britain is reducing everything at the moment. I'd like to tell you about the evidence that they're basing that argument on, and the idea of using a crime harm index as the primary guide to crime policy, not only in the US or the UK, but really anywhere in the world. Because the pressure is on, with thousands of police being laid off around the US, thousands fewer police predicted to be on the streets of the UK within a year, the prison population keeps rising in the US, and since 1990, the United States spent more money on prisons than on police. Even though in the UK they still spend three times more on police than on prisons. So what does that say about the potential benefit for investing more in policing in the US or the value of the proposed cuts in the UK prison population as long as some of that money can be used to preserve police numbers and police focus on the most effective ways to prevent crime? Now, let me give you a little historical context on this. I want you to imagine a city of 14 million people with no police department. And that is what Sir Robert Peel, as the person in charge of crime prevention in England, the Home Secretary, that's the situation he faced in 1829. There was virtually nobody sentenced to prison and virtually no paid police on the streets of that 14 million population country. Thousands of people were admittedly transported to Australia. But hundreds were being hung here in England, in Wales. And the Industrial Revolution was creating a huge middle class that was angry over the inequalities about voting. There were disorders. There was the use of the army against the population. And Peel said, enough, we have a new philosophy called utilitarianism. That philosophy says that crime can be deterred by certainty, swiftness, and severity of punishment. And what he said was, our policy is currently too severe. It places too much emphasis on hanging and not enough on the certainty of getting caught and of being held accountable, certainly not on doing that swiftly. So his idea was to create more certainty and to see whether certainty would work better than severity. He actually abolished the death penalty for most of the offenses to which it applied. During his period in power as Home Secretary in the 1820s, and then established the first modern police force in major cities in London in 1829 on these principles. First, that minimum force should be used. Second, and most important, that the test of success was not how much punishment the police were visibly seen to be imposing, but rather, how little crime there was, and the demonstrable absence of crime, the prevention and not the detection, not justice per se, is what's necessary for creating a better society, and that is the mission for police that he established in 1829, saying, go out there and manage the crime, manage the criminals, deter or intercept their crimes in the act, break up the fights, but don't drag everybody into court, don't prosecute, don't try to send people into very severe punishments, because that's not cost effective. And the juries won't even back you up, because the juries were refusing to convict people for stealing things if that meant that they were going to be hung. So Peel said reserve prosecution for the very worst cases, rather than the most recent government in Britain, rather than most district attorneys in the United States, who seem to be saying, if we've got a crime, we've got to prosecute, it's our obligation. Well, that's not the way it used to be seen in this society in the 1820s, and then with the murder rate as the best indicator. What we know historically is that the murder rate dropped, Britain became a much less violent society, and it didn't do it by building prisons. It did it by expanding police forces all over England and Wales, so that this country of 14 and then 20 million and then 25 million was policed by professionals under a rule of law who increased the certainty and the swiftness of punishment and certainly did not rely on severity of punishment. So that's a precedent for the current Justice Secretary of Britain, who has openly declared that he wants to reduce the prison population. That's a precedent for Newt Gingrich, the former Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States, who has advocated with several other conservative and liberal people, such as presidential candidate and U.S. Senator John Kerry. They're all advocating a reduction in the U.S. prison population because it's not cost effective. We know we could get crime down in Britain by using policing rather than prisons. Maybe if we refocused our priorities in many countries, we could get the same result. As measured by a very important distinction, and that is the distinction between the count of crimes and the harm of crimes. Most countries, the United States, the UK, India, they all announce each year how many crimes occurred, which makes about as much sense as announcing how many people caught a cold in the United States each year. All crimes are not created equal. Some are far more harmful than others. Yet governments publish crime totals completely unweighted by harm, as if a murder is just as bad as a shoplifting case. And even when we're publishing maps of crimes, as the UK has started to do for every postcode in the country, it's virtually impossible to interpret this kind of statistical reporting unless the citizens are informed by the government what this really means in terms of the danger of severe harm from crime. That's what most people are worried about in the United States. It's called the Willie Horton problem, the very serious crimes that are committed by some criminals who then drive up the rate of punishment and the use of prison for everybody else, even when we can now predict with a great deal of reliability that it's not going to happen with most offenders. But let's just go back to the harm itself. Let's think about whether if in a robbery murder you have a value of 100 and a car theft you give a value of 5, then in any 100 crimes the level of harm would depend entirely on what kind of mix you have. How many murders, how many car thefts. If you had 100 car thefts, then that would be a value of 500. If you had 100 murders, that would be a value of 10,000. That's a huge difference. And it's the kind of thing that police implicitly think about as they try to allocate their scarce resources to make societies safer. But as long as we are driving our decisions on crime by this unweighted idea of a crime count, rather than the crime harm index, or a CHI, which I'm developing with my colleague, former Chief Constable Peter Nehrud, who's been a member of the Sentencing Council, of Sentencing Guidelines Council of England and Wales. What we're trying to suggest is that governments everywhere should use a single bottom line, a single weighted index that evaluates whether crime is going up or down in terms of its harm, and not in terms of this incomprehensibly long list of categories that people have basically lost faith in, and that is undermining the legitimacy of policing in a highly middle class, highly educated society that isn't quite educated enough. Indeed, none of us are educated enough to look at all these different categories and make sense out of them unless we create a single index, much like the Consumer Price Index or some health indices that are used to measure these overall patterns and trends that make the situation much more transparent, much more comprehensible for democracies than a confusing flood of undigested data. Now, with the crime harm index, we can do several things. We can look at national trends in harm levels. We can compare police force areas or the crime rates in different cities. But we can also make decisions about individual criminals. We can manage the costs of managing individual criminals in relation to the benefits that our response will create in reducing harm. And that's where criminology comes in, because we now have very clear evidence that prisons are not doing much to reduce harm. Incapacitation certainly does work when we never let people out of prison. And you could argue that that's what prison is really good for people who have committed horrible crimes, who will never, in the United States anyway, they'll never be allowed back on the streets. And indeed, whether places like Britain or Scandinavia that do let people out after 10 or 15 years beyond committing very horrible crimes, whether the risk they're running when they do that is to undermine the legitimacy of the whole justice system, I think we could say that the general deterrent effect, the threat of going to prison, is something that has been impossible to measure. It's still conceivable that it's working to some degree, but our best estimates from this record-breaking, historically unprecedented mass incarceration level of 750 per 100,000 or more of the U.S. population going to prison, that has really not produced the benefit. And the more people we put in, the less cost-effective it's been, even from the evidence on general deterrence. The main point to compare policing in prisons is that if you take an offender, and that offender is a relatively low-risk person who's never been in prison, and you give them to the police to manage through a program of some sort of reminder that they can be prosecuted anytime you want. They might be brought into a meeting with their crime victim where they could apologize and try to make up for and at least listen to their victim give them a piece of their minds for the harm that they caused. This is called restorative justice. It's been tested in 12 experiments around the world. Consistently shows a moderate effect at preventing or reducing the subsequent frequency of convictions, and possibly, if the data could be reanalyzed with a harm index, would show a substantial reduction in harm, as indeed some of the experiments have already been analyzed to show that. We know that rehabilitation is expensive and difficult. We know that the requirements for rehabilitation can sometimes cause far more severity of punishment than may be effective in relation to spending that same money on certainty. So if the police could manage offenders as Robert Peel suggested they should, and indeed they did in Britain until the 1970s, when for various reasons they lost their discretion to keep people out of the criminal justice system and were pushed by politicians into bringing more people to court, even with the creation of the first prosecution service in the UK in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher, all of this made the law the primary means of managing crime without any evidence that that was a good idea. And now that we have increased evidence that when it goes to prison, that it's backfiring, it raises the comparative question of suppose the police were able to identify people who are not going to do substantial harm. And yes, they've broken into a car and they've taken some packages and smashed glass. And yes, they may have done other annoying things that haven't really seriously hurt anybody, psychologically upsetting to be sure, but is it the best thing then to prosecute and put them in prison, or would it be better for the police to just take them under their wing with a much more intensive, swift, and certain sense of accountability when the police get a hold of them, and then to have that approach itself rigorously tested to see whether it does a better job than prosecuting people, very often with the result that the prosecution drops the charges because there's problems with the evidence. And so there's no accountability. There's no certainty of being held to account for what you've done when you go that route. But if the police say, look, we will not prosecute if you keep your nose clean and if we can agree on how you're going to be handling yourself in the future, these minor offenders, even if they're frequent in their minor offenses, are very unlikely to commit the kind of serious harm that leads most people to think prison is a really good idea because it keeps people off the streets. That may be a really terrible idea if after 6 months or a year they come back onto the streets worse than when they were sent away. So what we know so far, at least in a Philadelphia population of 60,000 probationers, is that most offenders are low harm. Only 2%, still a pretty high rate, but 2% of the probationers in Philadelphia over a two-year period were charged with murder or attempted murder. But in a forecasting exercise using advanced data mining techniques, Richard Burke and his colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, myself included at the time, were able to identify people who are 75 times more likely to be charged with murder or attempted murder than other people on probation. And that capacity to distinguish the very dangerous from the super safe, yes, people who have committed crimes may commit crimes in the future, are not going to commit horrible crimes, murder, rape, etc. Those people can be dealt with, as the probation department is in Philadelphia, with a very minimal amount of supervision. And approximately 60% of the probation population in Philadelphia is identified this way. We're now working on developing a similar harm risk predictor for the police stations in the UK, where we can undertake an experiment that has been funded by the Monument Trust, a branch of the Sainsbury Family Foundations, which experiment will compare the flat prosecution approach. Anybody comes in, we have an arrest, we have an evidence base to send them forward for prosecution. That would be one arm of this experiment. And the comparison would be to say, let's look at the danger that this offender poses. And if this offender is very dangerous, let's prosecute them to the hilt and get even more evidence and try to see all of the different ways we can keep them off the streets, because this person who may have committed their first serious assault at the age of 12 has a much higher lifetime risk of killing somebody than the same, say, 22-year-old standing in front of the desk sergeant in the police lockup who is there on a first offense, who has no risk factors for very serious harm. That person can be referred to a police offender management unit of some sort that might work with other agencies, social service agencies, whatever might work, and all of that can be tested in the experiments that we propose to undertake here in Britain. What we do know is that if they are treated in this way in the station house, given the offer of not being prosecuted in exchange for some sort of cooperation with the police, that there's a very high take-up rate for almost any kind of diversion from prosecution of that sort that people are offered. We do know that in a Campbell Collaboration review of some 30 experiments around the world, Anthony Petrosino and his colleagues have concluded that on average for juveniles, people under 18, that there is less crime when they're not prosecuted than when they are. And in fact, there's even some evidence in that study that suggests the less you do with them altogether, as opposed to giving them service programs or other requirements to have contact with authorities, that they may be less likely to commit future crimes. And we can build on this knowledge for the policy proposal that we can reduce prison and save money that could be spent to increase policing and still perhaps cut the overall budget expenditures on criminal justice by focusing on the harm and not just the crime, and then testing that theory and all of the evidence on which it's based in the crucial comparison of prosecuting everybody who the police arrest, which is a widespread practice today, versus looking at everybody from a risk standpoint, saying who should have a red light that we need to stop them right now from doing anything else out in society at large because they are a time bomb waiting to go off, versus a green light that says, this is not a dangerous person. Let's give them a green light over to this offender management program, which does pretty much what Robert Peel wanted the British police to do and that the police did do in Britain for over a century, which is to manage crime and keep the harm down, keep the costs down, and keep the society a safe place to live. We can call this the Damocles Project, with the sword of Damocles of threatened prosecution hanging over their head. The one control test of that approach in relation to domestic violence for offenders who weren't present at the scene has shown that it was more effective than actually imposing arrest and punishment in actually reducing violence against women. Would that be true generally across all offenses? We don't know, but we're going to find out by doing these experiments in collaboration with British police agencies, and we look forward to the possibility of doing the same with both prosecutors and police in the United States. This is a way we can save on justice in a way, especially if the victims get consulted by the offender management teams, will be satisfying to victims, will make them feel that they have had more attention paid to the crime against them than they receive from court prosecutions, information about which is often denied to them. What victims want, according to our best research, is to have a voice, to be heard, to be able to know that somebody has done something about the crime against them. And based on the evidence we have so far, that is something that the police are better able to deliver if they can keep at least the low-risk offenders away from court and focus on the harm that's been done, trying to repair that harm and to prevent more harm to be caused in the future. These are the possibilities that criminology gives us. I hope that you'll read the paper that is downloadable at the website where this video is published. And if you have any questions, please contact us at the Jerry Lee Center for Experimental Criminology at the Institute of Criminology in the University of Cambridge. Thanks very much.